But a very practical application we've demonstrated in the Ecovative parking lot is we grew a tiny house. And you can drill a little hole in this tiny house and make a hole in it, and you can actually spritz that with water, and the fungus will reanimate and close the hole. Now, sometimes it'll reanimate, close the hole, make a mushroom, which you would not want. And sometimes it'll reanimate and get contaminated and grow another contaminant. And so this is where you really need the controllability and programmability to hone in a very robust response that's predictable.
Welcome to the SynBioBeta podcast, conversations with synthetic biology's leading thinkers on building a better world with biology. I'm your host, John Cumbers, the founder and the CEO of SynBioBeta, where tech meets bio and bio meets tech. This week on the SynBioBeta podcast, I am talking with Eben Bayer, the CEO and co-founder of the biomaterials company Ecovative. Our topic today is the mycelium revolution, how one mighty fungi can make food, plastic, and more. If you don't know what mycelium is, then stay tuned and we're going to find out. I'll be talking with Eben about why mycelium is an ideal host, not just for biochemical production, but also for biomaterials and structures. I'll be talking about Eben's conception of bioadaptation, what that is and what it means, and the relationship of synthetic biology to the good life. And I'll also be talking about what emerging products and markets he is most excited about these days, be it plastics, plant-based foods, or even scaffolding for growing human organs. Ecovative is a world-leading biomaterials company that is adapting natural processes to create sustainable materials. Eben has evangelized a strategy of bioadaptation around the world, including presentations at TED, PopTech, and Davos. Ecovative has been recognized as a tech pioneer by the World Economic Forum for its potential impact on climate change, by the Postcode Lottery Green Challenge, the EPA Environmental Award, and the Buckminster Fuller Challenge for socially responsible design. Welcome, Eben, and thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, John.
So I want to dive right in and understand a little bit about where you've been on this journey from Ecovative. I remember, because I've spoken to you many times about this, about it starting out at the Rensselaer Polytechnic University, I believe, in New York.
Yeah.
And tell us how you met your co-founder and tell us how the company began.
Well, Gavin likes to remind me that the first day I met him at RPI, we were freshmen, and I was giving him crap because he was still listening to a CD player. And, you know, at this point, MP3 players had just come out, and I got after him about that immediately. But he got over it. We became fast friends at school. We worked on a bunch of different design projects together. I'm actually looking at starting different businesses. But it wasn't until our senior year that we hit upon the field of mycelium and started to think about how we might use it as a material synthesis platform.
Awesome. And there was a particular professor whose class you met in, is that right? Or who you're very fond of? I remember he passed away. It's a sad story.
Yeah. So the real catalyst for the formation of Ecovative were two events. One, my really personal interest in looking to the natural world for great technological innovations and sort of recasting things that I grew up around, like pigs, chickens, and trees that I thought were sort of boring and old, and realizing that these represented some of the most incredible complexity and technology on the planet, and starting to think how, as an engineer, I might reimagine or readapt these to solve the problems that I saw facing the world from my seat as a student. And at the same time, I took a class called Inventor Studio, and the literal purpose was invent something that could have a positive impact on the world, that could go really big, patent it, right? So you have protection. Burt worked under Edwin Land at Polaroid and really believed and supported the patent system, and finally start a company. And Burt was serious about this. Most of the entrepreneurs that have come out of Rensselaer went through this class, and he not only supported us, but was our first investor.
So that's super interesting. So this commercial drive, and this, I mean, I see this throughout my travels around the world. We were in Europe recently for our thought leader retreat, and I visited both the Czech Republic and Slovenia, speaking to a couple of companies there, a couple of academic institutions, and boy, America does this right. We just have this drive to go make a difference in the world, and you make a difference in the world by starting a company and by competing in the marketplace of ideas and products, and nowhere else in the world gets this. They really don't. I mean, the UK kinda, but the culture is completely different. So it's really interesting hearing you talk about that it's really ingrained in some universities that this is the path you're on. An RPI being one of them, and you know, clearly MIT, Stanford, Harvard are all doing this very, very well, and it's very exciting to see entrepreneurs coming out of colleges with fantastic technology and then going and starting fantastic companies like you've done with Ecovative.
Yeah.
So let's dive into some of the new products that you've been working on lately. In particular, who would have thought that you could eat mycelium? But let's start there with what the hell is mycelium? I think it's the largest organism on the planet. Am I right? Or is that another fungi?
No, you're right. Well, mycelium is, the generically the root structure of mushrooms. And there's a honey mushroom population out in Western United States that I believe is the largest cohesive organism on the planet.
I love that. Honey mustard. It sounds like honey bucket. you started off the company making, people know you for this wonderful mushroom fungi packaging material. The idea was to replace polystyrene, flat screen TV packaging, with a biodegradable version that's made of fungi and uses also ag waste at the same time. So I've seen you grew Astage famously in 2015 at SynBioBeta, and it was this beautiful mixture of straw and ag waste and then fungal juice poured into it, and then it grows into this amazing mushroomy texture, which actually I still have on my office windowsill here. So that's what I think you're most famously known for. But now you've moved out into other products as well. So what are some of the other products that you're now excited about?
Well, could I just back up there and tell you a little bit about actually what I wanted to do when we started and what I've been working on the whole time, independent of what application you might see?
Sure.
So when I started thinking about mycelium, my dream was not to make packaging or building insulation or plant-based meat scaffolding or medical scaffolding. Though those are all fields we're either active in or becoming active in. My dream was to create a generic molecular assembly platform. I was heavily influenced by Drexler's work on nanotechnology and how there's plenty of room at the bottom. And if we can harness atoms and reconfigure them at will, we will unlock unbelievable potential in the world. And I came to this through the mindset of a mechanical engineer, looking at what happened in computer chips and photonics and saying, boy, we'll do this again like little rods and pins at the atomic scale. And it was at that level that I started to think about single-celled organisms. And that was my first insight, was like, which many people have now had or had already had, realizing that complexity on the molecular level existed in nature. And so for me, I wanted to build a generic molecular assembly platform. And when I saw mycelium growing in nature, that's what I saw. I saw this organism that was fractally dividing on a microscopic scale, but over time could build these very large complex structures. You might think of them as mushrooms. You might think of them as the largest colonial organism in the world, as you referenced at the start of the show. But it provided this bridge between the microscopic or micron level world and the large human level world and everything in between. And everything I've done since then has been about figuring out the right application at the right time for the maturity of that platform.
So I wish we could see some pictures of what you're describing, and maybe we can write up and have some of these on the website that will accompany the podcast later on. So when you were looking at these things under the microscope, and I've never looked at mycelium under the microscope, so what kind of structures are you seeing? Because when I think of fungus and when I think of your materials, I don't think of them as orderly structure. I think of them as kind of very organic, kind of messy kind of things. So when you look at mycelium growing underneath the microscope, are you seeing something completely different?
I am, yeah. It follows a whole series of rules. You know, so you imagine hyphal cells, which make up the mycelial body. You could imagine a tube, if you could visualize a tube right now. And then every certain unit length of tube, it'll branch. And that's considered your branching frequency. And then those branches will branch. And then those branches are not in a 2D plane, but they're in a 3D plane. So when you zoom all the way out, you get something that, yeah, looks like this organic white blob. But if you zoom all the way in, there's actually a very regular, predictable pattern of branching. And this is essentially an organism that assembles molecules in 3D space. And by modulating, even in the lab, your environmental conditions and other triggers, you can change branching frequency and cell wall composition to essentially change what that matrixy looks like on a micron scale. And if you look at it under a microscope, it's really beautiful. And if you watch time-lapse of mycelium growing, it's kind of mesmerizing because, you know, it's like gray goo, right? It like slides across a surface. And as you zoom in, you realize it's actually these unit cell branches that are forming, branching, and assembling.
I had no idea it was on such a regimented, unit of length that they branch or even what they look like. And it's my fault. You've invited me to come visit a number of times and I haven't taken you up on it. So I definitely want to make it up to Troy in upstate New York and visit you and the whole team. But that sounds really cool. So which of these new products or new applications of Mycelium are you most excited about?
Well, at the moment, I'm particularly excited about the work we're doing around scaffolding for plant-based meats for two reasons. One, there's just a tremendous business opportunity there. This space is exploding, and it's exploding in response to real consumer demand for this for these products. And the other reason is, as I've learned more about animal agriculture on an industrial scale, I realize the staggering impacts to environment associated with farming animals, particularly as it relates to CO2, but also the ethical issues. And so I really love finding important problems in the world where there's a strong business case. And if you're successful in your business case, you can really move the needle in one of the other big challenges, which is how do we take care of spaceship Earth? And then the other thing that is sort of our business thesis at Ecovative is we want to make sure we apply Mycelium to problems that Mycelium is best suited to solve. And I mean that in that if you were to apply all other technical approaches, Mycelium would still be your default choice. And when we look at plant-based meats and how people are going to move from ground beef or ground chicken to whole cuts of meat, like a porterhouse or a fish fillet, Mycelium seems like the best possible choice. And so I'm very excited to get to work on that opportunity right now.
Interesting. So I've been not that vocal about my support of cell-based agriculture. I've been very vocal about my support for products such as the Impossible Burger. I think that we can replicate the texture and flavor and sizzle quality of meat without it needing to be made from mammalian cell culture. But what do you think?
I agree. I think there'll be a place for both. And I think the reality is cell-based meat's incredibly exciting because the value proposition is it's molecularly identical, right? So in theory, that removes all objections around product quality. In reality, what you've done is you've given yourself a tremendously hard technical problem to solve, which, you know, it's fine. We'll work it out. But it's not the solution for next year. And what I think Impossible has done, and others in this space, but particularly with their work around heme, is they've proven that you can unpack the constituents that go into a whole cut of meat and reimagine them using non-mammalian cell lines to get the same experience as a human. And that's what you're really selling. And that's where our excitement is around the Mycelium as well, because we think our fibers can replicate the fibers you might find in a whole cut of meat.
Now, I was discussing this with Seth Bannon, who's an investor at 50 Years, and saying, do you really need to do mammalian cell culture to make meat? And he said, well, are you still eating? He said, why aren't you vegetarian? And I said, well, there's no good reason why I'm not a vegetarian. I could be a vegetarian. He said, well, that's why you need to do mammalian cell culture to make meat, because you need to switch over more people, and then only going to do it if it really feels and tastes real. So I think he's got a good point, and he's investing in a lot of these in a lot of companies in the food space.
Well, let me just say, John, we're in private beta right now with a number of cell-based meat companies that are using our scaffolding to grow mammalian cells.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. And the reason is the same problem, right? So you look at plant-based meat, you need a structure or a scaffolding to go from ground meat to whole cuts of meat. If you look at cell-based meat, the current problem in the industry is how the heck do we even grow these cells in mass? But once you grow a lot of these beautiful chicken cells or pig cells or bovine cells, do you really want to mush them up and extrude them into a nugget? Like, that's the lowest value use for mammalian cells, right? You want to make a porterhouse or a T-bone or, you know, a Kobe beef steak, right? And to do that, you need some sort of 3D scaffolding that you can grow cells on that's low cost, biocompatible, and ideally edible. And if you look at the state-of-the-art in cellular scaffolding, you're really limited to some obscure plant-based tissues like spinach leaves, which don't translate well to steak. If you look at the micron-level structure of our Mycelium scaffolding, it actually fits really, really well for cell culture. So we want to support both industries. I just think pragmatically, one's going to go faster than the other, and that's okay. We'll need both, but let's put our effort in the one that can, at least from Ecovative's point of view, that we can bring to fruition sooner.
You're going to be speaking on a panel at SymbioBeta, or I think Andy Bass on your team is going to be speaking on a panel at SymbioBeta on materials. We also have another session on the future of food, and one of the speakers in that session will interest you. His name is Tom Simmons, and the company was called Cambridge Glycoscience, I believe, and is in the process of renaming. Then they changed to STEM. They're renaming to something else because of some conflict with the naming. But the it's a very interesting product, which is sugar that cannot be consumed, metabolized by the body. I don't know if you've heard of this. So it's a special kind of sugar. It tastes like sugar. It has the structural properties of sugar in cookies and pastries. But when it gets into the body, it just passes right through. And it's really interesting because Tom joined us on our hiking in Europe for our retreat recently. And I hadn't realized the distinction between the drinks business and the food business. And drinks have had artificial sweeteners. I've got a can of LaCroix here, you know, artificial flavors. It's very easy to put stuff that's soluble in the water. But try to put these artificial sweeteners like aspartame or stevia into cookies and cakes, and it doesn't work because the sugar is about 50 to 70% of the structure of that thing. So structure is so important around food, and it's something that I hadn't appreciated. And actually, a couple of years ago when you told me, yeah, we're going into food scaffolding, I was like, what? You know, it just didn't make sense to me. Everything that you've just explained and everything that I see going on at Impossible Foods and in all these other food tech companies, it really does make a whole lot of sense to see mycelium as a platform for scaffolding in all sorts of future foods.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful analogy because food really is the combination of taste, flavor, and texture. And we have cracked through extrusion, which is like a 1940s, 1950s chemical process, making a lot of extruded foods, which range from jams to ground beef. And so the next lever of texture, though, why does meat taste like meat? It's micron-level structure that your tongue detects. And so that's why you need a micron-level assembly platform if you're really going to replicate that convincingly. Or you go all the way to cell-based and you just grow the damn cell structure again, right? So that's your quid pro quo.
We're talking with Eben Bayer, the CEO and the co-founder of the biomaterials company Egovative, and we're going to take a short break for this message, so don't go away.
SynBioBeta 2019 takes place October 1 through 3 in San Francisco. You'll meet the innovators and companies, find new opportunities, partner up, and discover the potential of the biological industrial revolution. As a special thanks to Egovative for making today's podcast possible, we're giving you, the podcast listener, $100 off your SynBioBeta ticket if you use the promo code Egovative. That's Ecovative at checkout. Visit us at 2019.synbiobeta.com to learn more.
Hi, folks. This is John Cumbers, the founder and the CEO of SynBioBeta, and I'm talking with Eben Bayer, CEO and co-founder of the biomaterials company Egovative. Eben, you're a self-described evangelist of bioadaptation. What is bioadaptation?
Bioadaptation is a term I coined many years ago that described what we were doing at Egovative, which referred to not reprogramming life from the bottom up to make new compounds, but taking more complex physical properties that already exist and reimagining how they could be used in the world. And so everything I've described so far on the show regarding mycelium is actually non-GMO. We can do all this through modulating environmental conditions, physical conditions, nutrients, and basically coaxing the organism to do something different. And in that way, most of our work over the past 10 years is akin to domesticating a new crop, like when we domesticated corn and turned that into an industrial crop. So our history has been around domesticating these fungi to make materials. As I look forward for the next 10 years, we're all about taking the best of high throughput, high replicate science, which has been done on the single cellular level, and applying that to multicellular organisms like mycelium.
So why the term bioadaptation? You're thinking about kind of coaxing the organism to do what you want rather than genetic engineering, or
well, when we started Egovative, we were far. Genetic engineering inside of the filamentous fungi we were doing was almost impossible. You know, that is no longer true for us today. We're working closely with DARPA and in our own internally funded research to engineer our organism. I view that as a critical step in the long-term goal of making this a generic molecular assembly platform. So when I talked about bioadaptation in the past, it was all around taking existing organisms and finding ways to re-express them without genetic modification until we could get to the tools to build them. So this is something I talked about a lot when we were starting Egovative. Still relevant today because our food products will be non-GMO, but will become less relevant as we go forward from this point.
Got it. You advise the Origins Project at Arizona State University, and I know that you have an interest in space. Where do you see the interesting technology intersections between what you're doing here on Earth and what we could one day be doing in space?
Yeah, so top priority for me is protecting spaceship Earth, and I think using biological technology to do so is the right fit. With that said, I've dreamed since I was a kid of going to Mars and colonizing other planets in the solar system, and I'm unbelievably excited to see the work Elon Musk and others are doing around making us an interplanetary species. And I think it's totally fine to expend Earth resources on it. You know, you often hear we should focus on Earth first before we leave the planet. And that totally ignores all the other horrible things we're doing with capitalism. And so, like, it's okay for us to have multiple goals. Where biology plays a role is as we develop better ways to manage spaceship Earth's ecosystem through harnessing biology, those same learnings will be really, really relevant to going to other planets, whether it's better ways to feed people and transport or ways to make structures that can repair themselves and assemble themselves without big factories around them. And so I think those two goals really overlap nicely.
I don't know if you saw Jeff Bezos's announcement about their lunar lander, but in the same presentation, they talked about what they could do on the moon, what they could do on Mars. And what I hadn't really comprehended before was the vision that Jeff has for these O'Neillian rings, these Taurus-like spaceships that could actually be in orbit. So he has a vision for keeping the Earth for light industrial and residential and taking heavy industry into orbit. If you had the choice of where to take your first scale-up facility, would it be in orbit? Would it be on the moon or straight to Mars?
That's a great question. I mean, I think of that in the context of the gravity well, right? So where's the product going? And why would you have your heavy manufacturing in space? But for my personal interest, I'd want to be on a planetary body. So I'll pick Mars.
Okay. I could go there. And talk a little bit more about DARPA. Now that I can understand this tubular network of mycelium growth, I can immediately see where the connections are with what you've been doing with Chris Voigt and DARPA. Tell us a little bit about that project. And presumably, you know, DARPA, the Defense Agency's Research Project Administration, is all about the warfighter and, you know, bases in the field and creating structures and materials that can be grown in situ in some remote place in the Middle East or Iraq rather than what's going on here in the U.S. But, you know, give us a flavor of what you think the interest is there.
Yeah, so the rapidly deployable structure component is important to DARPA for military applications, but also humanitarian relief. And part of the vision is how could you take local resources if you're, you know, in an organic environment like a forest, can you chip up materials as a substrate? And if you're in an urban environment, can you reuse or recycle rubble and other materials as an aggregate? But I think the more exciting component of the program from my view and DARPA's view is making the material smart. So all the products we're describing today, the functionality is embedded in the micron structure of the mycelium, which expresses itself as a product performance aspect. It could be tensile strength, it could be compression in packaging, could be texture in meat. What we're building with DARPA is materials that stay alive and they respond to the environment, they react to the environment, and they potentially make things that change the environment around them. You can do this in single-celled chassis, and there are lots of really great biosensors being developed today where you have a freeze-dried E. coli, you reactivate it, it's got a signal in it for some poison you might find in a water supply, and it alerts you. Mycelium, especially our composite, is interesting because you could imagine deploying that in a field and having it reanimate when it was injured and repair itself. And so it's moving it from the informational domain, I turned red, don't drink the water, to the physical domain. There's a poison in the air around you. I'm going to release an antidote into the room. I'm going to signal you, and I'm going to seal up these holes. And biology does this all the time. And it's sort of figuring out what is the right platform or chassis to make this real for the physical objects humans need.
Very cool.
And then from the Ecovative perspective, it has allowed us, you know, they've invested about $10 million in the program. We've had to develop some very bespoke tools to transform our filamentous fungi, develop the protocols, and the ability to actually engineer our bug.
I'm imagining, I think they're called lithops, the stone.
Lichen.
Say it again, sorry?
Lichen?
No, not lichen. Lichen are pretty cool as well and very radiation resistant. I think it's L-Y-T-H-O-P-S, lithops. They're like stone plants. You're not familiar with what with them?
I don't think so, yeah.
Anyway, they're really cool, and they grow in the desert, and they're radiation resistant as well. I'm just thinking you could grow a giant one of those as a home, either on Earth or in space at some point. So you live off the grid in the woods in upstate New York, the Hudson Valley. Tell us about how you live and how that kind of your ethos of sustainability, I know, is very important to you.
Yeah, I live a lot, actually, like how I grew up in Vermont. And I grew up, I'll tell you where I grew up first. So I grew up on a working farm in Vermont. We chopped our own firewood. Our hot water was provided by a solar hot water heater my dad made in the 70s. So it was just, you know, pipes on the roof. In the winter, we made a fire, water jacket in the wood stove, which is how people in Vermont made hot water for 100 years. We grew all our own food. We ate mostly all our own food. And in the summer, you bathed in the pond because, like, you know, maybe there wasn't hot water. And it was just, that was just how we lived. And when I went to college, it was like total culture shock because I realized actually the entire world in terms of how you live is inverted. And it's all about bringing massive energy flows from elsewhere, producing tons of waste and sort of keeping your little homeostatic environment safe. And when I started Ecovative, I lived in an apartment, right? Lived in an apartment for 8 years in downtown Troy, but it was killing my soul. And so as soon as we could, my wife and I bought a plot of land outside of Troy. And first year we slept in a tent all the way through New York winter. Second year we built a cabin, wood stove, hot water heater in it. But unlike my dad, who was a real back to the farm kind of guy, we've gone high tech. So I've got salvaged Tesla batteries in my basement that are coupled to a large solar array that runs heat pumps to heat or cool the house. I do have a wood stove still. So I, you know, I cut all my own wood for fuel in the winter. We're starting to grow our own food. And we have a micro hydro as well. So we've dammed up a small stream for sort of peak power and power storage. But for me, it's all about proving you can sort of build a base and live sustainably on your own and in harmony with nature. And for me, you know, I talk a lot about sustainability at work. I think at work, I got to eat my own dog food. It's way tastier. Now we're making food instead of packaging. And at home, I want to live those values too.
I love it. Where are you in terms of, you know, being able to scale production of any of these food systems? And are you, I've invested in one company, 3F Bio, that's also a mycelium microprotein company. But everything we've talked about so far has been around the structure. That's where you see your key piece of the puzzle or the engineerable structure for growing food.
Yeah, so I think when you're a technology-driven company, it's really important to understand what is it that's different about your approach. And so for us, it's absolutely taking one cell and building it into many cells with structure. With that said, the nutritional profile of the strains we work with have a great protein content. They have great flavor compounds. They have many of the same nutritional benefits the microprotein companies out there talk about. It's just not our number one selling aspect. So if you just want a powdered additive that contains protein, you should do that in liquid fermentation. If you want a structure that has protein, flavor, and other health benefits, our structure could really help you in that regard. In terms of scale, the composite side of our business, which supports things like packaging, building materials, acoustical panels, et cetera, we scaled that to over 1 million pounds of production here in New York State. Wow. And it's now been licensed around the world. And we're in the process of activating a partner in Paradise, California, actually, that'll be online by the end of the year. And so that business is now scaling independent of Ecovative, effectively through a network of solid-state CMOs. So the liquid fermentation folks have big tanks. We're starting to build a network of people who grow fungus and solid-state culture around the world. We intend to do the same thing in the food space through a different network of producers.
Oh, fantastic. I'd love to introduce you to some more folks out here in California. We'd always talked about having a scale-up facility here, so I'm excited to hear that.
It's happening.
Yeah. Any relation to the fires up in Paradise, or just coincidence?
Yeah, it was, actually. This was one of the only buildings that didn't burn down. The team that had built it actually to do some cultivation of hemp cuttings. So this really big, clean warehouse they're doing that business in. And they approached us about having kind of like the right fit to do this. And they were.
Very interesting. And I just want to go back to the topic about the living materials project that you described with DARPA. So now move that forward to a commercialized opportunity. What would be the first kind of living system that I might have in my home that might have the Ecovative stamp on it?
So I think that... the practical applications for these that I see in the near term are actually more on the water remediation side. So mycelium is already known, living bales of straw, for instance, are known to be good pollutant remediators. So if you have runoff in an area, Paul Stamets pioneered this work around putting inoculated bales of mycelium around that then create compounds that actually treat the runoff. What we would like to do in those spaces is make that a predictable industrial process. And so we've developed properties to make giant cubes or blocks of mycelium. You could imagine lining an entire waterway with these living blocks that would then act as bioremediating filters in a very predictable manner. And we've done work out in Kings County, Seattle, doing wetland rafts, a pilot with the municipal waste treatment center there doing wetland rafts. I think your home in terms of living materials are a long way away, but a very practical application we've demonstrated in the Ecovative parking lot is we grew a tiny house. And you can drill a little hole in this tiny house and make a hole in it, and you can actually spritz that with water, and the fungus will reanimate and close the hole.
No way. That's awesome.
Yeah. Now, sometimes it'll reanimate, close the hole, make a mushroom, which you would not want. And sometimes it'll reanimate and get contaminated and grow another contaminant. And so this is where you really need the controllability and programmability to hone in a very robust response that's predictable.
And we have a photo of that on the article that we wrote up, 5 reasons why Jeff Bezos should be investing in synthetic biology. You can go to that article on Forbes.com and see the mushroom material, the mushroom house.
I hope everyone's emailing it to him.
Say it again, sorry?
Oh, I said I hope everyone's emailing that article to Jeff.
Yeah. If tweet at Jeff if he hasn't seen it yet. I want to touch on the topic of augmentative neurosystems. I know this is something that's near and dear to your heart. Maybe describe what an augmentative neurosystem is, and what kinds of systems do you hope for in the future, and how do you think synthetic biology is going to have an impact on that?
Well, so this is one of my core interests, which has hung around since I graduated from Rensselaer, and it was around using biology to create better materials and molecular assemblers, and then two, like how are we going to link up our bio supercomputer, our brain, to the supercomputers we're building digitally. And I'm so psyched to see that it's actually happening. There's a couple different approaches in the world right now. Control Labs, which is a Lux-funded company, is developing non-invasive ways to predict or measure actually neuron-level events without being invasive, which will allow you to control and interact with a computer. And Elon Musk, I think as many folks now know, in typical Elon fashion, is going full on with Neuralink, you know, drilling holes in your head and putting electrons in there. Where I think biology could be useful is in the second scenario. One of the major challenges with implanting electrons in the human brain is rejection, effectively. And how do you prevent these electrodes from being encased in proteins and other things where the body tries to eliminate the electrode? And so I could imagine certain biological mediators that sit in between the electrode and the human tissue, which either allow it to stay stable or actually mediate communications, and also potentially translate the chemical gradients and chemical signals you see in the brain into impulses that are detectable by the electrodes. Because neural activity is, yes, it's a pulse of electricity, but it's also what's the bath of chemicals happening in your brain.
And you think the biggest impact is going to be on the input to your brain or on the output from your brain?
Well, personally, my interest has actually been on the input side. So I think being able to change, you know, our highest bandwidth method of input is visual. And actually, most people's brains are significantly larger in terms of visual computation. And so I'm really think it would be powerful to have a different a method that was non-photonic to do input into your brain. Like if you're doing CAD and could just have your sense of proprioception linked to a 3D model, like your understanding of an object or a machine would be like massively improved to what you can then translate through a 2D plane. Output's also interesting. But I do think the bigger impacts to human may be on the input side.
Very cool. So I apologize. We've jumped all over the place in this podcast, back and forward to mostly to food and back again to something else. But I want to go back to food for the last question, because it's something that is pretty interesting to me, which is thinking about how we interact with engineered living systems and thinking where the future of synthetic biology lies. You've probably read Terry Pratchett books.
Big Pratchett fan.
Yeah, I haven't actually read some of his books in a long time. But one of the characters in the Color of Magic, his first book, is this chest that runs around and it has like 12 legs. Yeah, something like that. Does it have wings as well? I don't think so. I think it just has legs. And I've dreamt of that, a biological version of this thing that could just kind of trot around with you at the airport, and you don't need to put your baggage on any conveyor belt. It just runs along behind you and hops up into the overhead bins and pulls the handle back down after it's jumped in. And I think we'll get there. I think we will be able to engineer biology well enough that we can create chests with legs that run after you. I don't know whether it's going to be in 20 years or in 50 years or in 100 years or more, but I believe humanity will get there. Our mastery of biology will get there. Now, hopefully, nobody, I think, in their right mind would want this. Well, I don't know. That's a discussion. No. I was actually going to say would want this thing to have a brain. They wouldn't want this thing to be a sentient being. I don't think. Maybe they would. This is the deepness that we're going to go today on the podcast. Is if you designed a walking suitcase to run around and carry your things, would you want it to be sentient, or would you want it to be dumb? Would you want it to be self-aware, or would you just want it to be a robot? And I think the safer way is the robot. You want this thing to be.
So you want robotic brains and bio parts? Is that where you're going?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting. Yeah. I mean, because otherwise we're creating this whole new species of things. And where it goes is, so let's now imagine we've had these kinds of things. A horse. We, you know, before the car, I don't know how many thousands of millions of horses there were, and that's exactly what they were these things that ran around and carried stuff for us, and in some countries they still do, so yeah, where I'm going with this is now let's take it back to food production, because I think the ultimate that you'd want in one of these living systems that's going to run around like a walking suitcase is for it to be able to feed itself. You it needs to get its energy from somewhere. So you can imagine at SFO there's a little, you know, a little water trough for these things to go and drink from or eat from, so that they've got the energy then to get on the flight with you. And then it quickly becomes back to, well, this is not much more than a horse. Then it's a farm animal that we've now, but it's a highly engineered thing that's gonna do that. But it kind of goes full circle now that, hang on, we've just, with cell-based agriculture, we're saying, no, we don't want these things that are living, breathing, walking around, eating, pooping, and then we eat them. Instead, we're gonna take that and we're gonna put it in a lab in a fermenter and feed it sugar and get out a steak. And now, do you see where I'm going? It's like it would be then full circle.
I have two comments on that. One is, I think you're right on, and I actually think that the full circle stack of SynBio starts with single-celled organisms, moves into multicellular predictable organisms like mycelium, and ends up back in horses and pigs and luggage like you describe. And I think if we do it right, that idealized world sounds like the Garden of Eden. Right? Where like trees just make the food you need and the environment takes care of itself. And like you kind of end up back where we started, but with full control over the biological environment. And I kind of do see that as where the world could head. And then just on the note about cell ag, I mean, I do think there, and other people have raised this as a thought experiment, but it sure seems like it would be easier to engineer chickens that don't have brains than to engineer bioreactors to support the muscle cells in chickens. And it makes people squeamish because people don't like to think about ourselves as complex biological robots, but it is pragmatically gets to the same ethical path and I think would be way easier. And I'm surprised that approach has not been explored anywhere.
I sometimes like to turn the table at the end of the podcast only to very special people and give them the option to ask me the last question. Is there a question that you would like to ask me?
Yeah, there is, John. And you're at the nexus of this industry, and I would say biological technology in general. You seem to know everything that's going on. You seem to know everyone, and you always seem to know what's coming before I ever hear about it. And so, you know, my question for you is if the ultimate expression of engineered biology is things like the luggage that follow you around at the airport and, you know, ending back up in multicellular creatures that maybe take us back to something that looks like the Garden of Eden. How do you perceive the rate of change? Are we on track to see this happen in our lifetimes? Does it feel slow to you, or does it feel fast? Like, where are we in this journey?
It feels very, it feels very slow, but very fast at the same time. So what are we actually measuring? Synthetic biology is about making biology easier to engineer. Well, is biology easier to engineer now than 10 years ago? Sure. How much easier is it? I have no idea. So we're not really, as a field, that focused on the goal. And I'd like to be more focused on the goal. And one of the activities that we're just starting is a whole working group at SynBio Beta around benchmarking for strain engineering. And so how do Zymergen and Ginkgo compete and compare in terms of going through the design, build, and test cycle of a yeast cell to produce butanol, for example? I don't know. They do have internal standards and internal metrics. They don't talk to each other and compare them, and as an industry, we move forward. And so that's one thing that I started recently with Eric Hobbs, the CEO of Berkeley Lights, is an initiative all around benchmarking. And there's a professor at Berkeley who, in the 1990s, Rob Leachman, he started going to the fabs, the microprocessor fabs, and helping them to do this. And so he's now starting to do that with synthetic biology companies as well. We got a workshop on this at SynBio Beta in October. So I think that we're moving pretty slowly in terms of making biology easier to engineer. Part of that is because we're not measuring things and we're not measuring the right things. And there's some initiatives that we're doing to try to do to try to improve on that. The other part is that we are not moving very fast because we really haven't had the resources that we need to fully deploy biology at scale on a planetary scale. And so I think we need to do that. And I think there's movements both in the US government and elsewhere that are going to really start to open the spigot of funding and really take this to the next level. And then I think we'll start to really start moving faster. I do think that there are some really nice examples of consumer products out there that are starting to move the needle and show a sign of things to come. Andy Bass is part of the Ecovative team. He's the founder, as you know, Biopop, and I think that was one of the early really cool products was the Nightlight from Dinoflagellates that he produced. Living inks, I think we've talked about before, that are doing cyanobacteria-based inks that grow on the paper. Zbiotics, the engineered probiotic for hangover cure, which I know you took
I got a couple
earlier
of,
this year.
A couple in my office right now.
At Beta Space. I think there's some very, very exciting forward-thinking consumer products out there, and we ain't seen nothing yet.
Amen.
Well, Eben, it's been a fun wander through the minds of a mycelium giant such as yourself. And I want to thank you for sharing the time with us on the podcast today. I think this is one of the most exciting and interesting podcasts that I've done, and I think people are really going to enjoy listening to it. So thank you for joining us.
John, thanks for everything you do.
On the next SynBio Beta podcast, our guest will be Tom Dierking, Design Director of Transformational Platform Technologies at Procter & Gamble.
Well, the digital environment we operate in today is just changing everything. That, in concert with some of the new technologies that we're developing, of which EC30 is one, it's just an exciting time to be able to try and identify what's the consumer value equation we're trying to develop with this new technology and get it in their hands as fast as possible.
The topic is building naturally inspired products for 2020 and beyond. John will be talking with Tom about his passion for transforming the consumer experience, Procter & Gamble's revolutionary line of water-free products, and where he sees synthetic biology impacting the way that consumer brands do business. So keep listening.
So I again want to thank Eben Bayer for joining us today, and also to thank Ecovative for making today's podcast possible. I also thank you, the listener, for checking us out. If you enjoyed this, then leave us an iTunes review, or more importantly, share the SynBio Beta podcast with a friend. This is John Cumbers signing off and hoping that all your DNA dreams come true. I didn't really get the Garden of Eden analogy, and I didn't want to dig into it. So,
well, I guess my thought, and you know, I like to come up with for things like this is a big, like if you think really deeply about where synthetic biology will go, like you go where you're going, which is like, well, engineer luggage that follows you around, but isn't that kind of like a horse? And so in my head, I think, well, what are the stories humans told themselves about like when living on planet Earth wasn't like fighting nature and like needing to build houses to keep, you know, tigers out, but like where somehow you were in this biome that had provided everything you need. And I'm not a religious person. I don't know a huge amount about religious orthodoxy, but like the Garden of Eden comes to mind as this like biome where everything was provided and everything was perfect. And it was like this biological utopia. And then humans were thrown out of it. And so I just feel like there's some motif to unravel there for someone who's like more philosophical than I am.
So you're saying that the Garden of Eden, and I don't know my religious history either. So that was the idea. It was the perfect place. And then
you didn't need clothes. You didn't need shelter. You didn't need farming, right? Because the biome provided around you. And then humans were out of it and you had to build farms and hunt in by shelter. And so like, you know, when you're sick, you go to the tree and you need an apple with aspirin in it. No problem. Eat the apple, you know, the aspirin apple, you know, and, you know, just that idea, like maybe your house is a giant fungi house that's like, you know, looks like a home, but is self-repairing.
And so it was that Adam ate the apple. Right. And that was the.
Oh, yeah. And then got kicked out. So, but you know, he was allowed to eat other things, I believe. I think it was the apple was just.
Oh, it was the forbidden apple. Okay. Interesting.
But I think the idea was they lived there. They lived there forever. They weren't going to grow old. Like it provided for everything. They didn't have clothes. Like, I don't know. I've only seen a couple pictures, you know, on this topic. But I do think, because if you imagine like biology can eat everything eventually, which I believe, you know, I think microcomputers we're going to have because like, that domain's so powerful, but like everything around you will be biological. You know, your house will be alive. Your luggage will be alive. Your clothes, you know, will either be alive or grown. What does that Earth actually have to look like?
I'm now thinking back to my days of singing in the choir in church, and it was the misogynistic story that it was actually Eve that ate the apple, but the serpent beguiled her. I do remember that. Well, this was great. Actually, we should totally include this in the podcast, this outtake, because I think it closes the loop. So thanks again, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Evan.
Thanks, John.
What a fun time. See you all soon.